Nice way to start the show with Vince and help me Italian. No,
it's Vin Infante.
Yeah, but Infante. Okay. Vin Infante is here and drinking out of a large jug of water. Yes, because hydration is key, everybody. But I'm just going to roll back into what our conversation was. So the Orthodox Jews with the tunnels under, can we talk? You're like New Jersey kind of guy. You're like my guy to have this conversation. And I said that my hat vibe and hair was like really leaning towards like tunnels. So can we talk about what the heck is going on?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I saw at least four guys that looked like you, not just.
No one would doubt it.
That was so freaking interesting because I actually didn't really know about it. The way I stumbled upon it is because there was a guy who felt so vindicated because he was talking. And people thought he was crazy because he's like, I swear to God, I'm not crazy, but I keep hearing Yiddish under the floor. And I live on the first floor and we have no basement. I don't understand. And so he was putting out a bunch of tweets and people were like, this guy's nuts. And as soon as this story came out, all of his tweets, he retweeted and said, I was right. Vindication. Like
Vindication. I saw that story pop and I immediately called the first Jewish person I know, who's my father-in-law. And I was like, you guys building tunnels? What's happening here? Have you been going to New York and building tunnels? And he goes, I have no idea what you're talking about. And I was like, that's what they said.
Filming of it was even more interesting. If you saw the clips, they started piling into the tunnels because the city came with cement mixers and trucks and they were going to fill the tunnels. So all these Jewish guys just ran into the tunnels and all you see is their heads with the hats. They like look like gophers, just a whole platoon of them. They wound up arresting like 10 or 12 of these guys. And it was so strange too, because they started like ripping their walls off when the police came, and they just started like, they had like old mattresses and stuff there for whatever reason. They were throwing them. It was the weirdest thing. Like who had on their 2024 bingo card, Jews in tunnels? Who had that?
I'm going to call a buddy Griff. He would be the guy, but that's an intense, I don't even know that anybody else truly would have thought that would have happened. I mean, look, I get it. It's brilliant. I mean, there's a reason why the Jewish people are so hardy. These guys, we know how to like get it done. I say we because I'm loosely associated with my family, but we know how to get it done, man. I'm telling you, they will. You say COVID, they say, No. I got to tell you a quick story, a funny story about this. You'll appreciate this. And then we're going to get into all things, Vince, and why you're so amazing and such a great human being, how we met. But I'm in the airport in San Diego with my husband, okay? We're coming back from filming Jocko and we're sitting there and my husband's wearing a ERT t-shirt. So if you don't know what ERT is like this brand from Coronado Island. It's like they donate money to the C4 Foundation for Navy SEALs. It's this whole thing, this really great company, ERT. Anyway, and the shirt on the back has actually got a photo of Chuck Norris kicking a shark in the face because that, you know, ERT SEALs, right? So they're like, Shark Week sucks. So he's wearing this shirt. He's not at all dressed as if he looks Jewish. He's with a wife who's heavily tattooed and covered in gold. Makes little sense. And then I'm sitting there and this gentleman walks over to us and he's with his wife and they are Orthodox, like Orthodox, like multiple kids, kosher, eating at a Baggies. Can I have the plastic cup to go get my water? Like the whole vibe. He comes over and he stops in front of us. And I immediately get concerned because I'm like, what's happening? And he looks at my husband. And my husband's just like on his phone. And he looks up and he goes, can I help you? And he goes, I'm not kidding. He leans in and he goes, are you Jewish? And my husband goes, my dad is, my mom's not. So, I mean, you know how that works. And he looks at me and he goes, And Brady goes, how did you know that? And he goes, we have a detector. And he, out of the entire airport, points Brady out. And I went, well, it could have been your nose, but I didn't want to be the one to say it. But regardless, they pointed us out like it was nothing. I mean, I am not, I was born and raised Catholic, so I, you know, but I did marry into a husband that has the features. So I will say it was a little wild to experience that. And then again, immediately we called the first person we could think of, your father-in-law, and told him. And he was like, you kind of look Jewish. I mean, it would make sense. Like, you're ruining the joke, man. You're not getting the point that he came from the whole airport to walk over to us of all people. Anyway, it was fantastic. You had to be there, I suppose, but it was hilarious. But I digress. Yeah. Welcome to the show, my friend. How are you doing today?
Doing better than the guys in the tunnels, I'll tell you what.
Man, I don't know that I'm ever going to like stop thinking about that. It just makes me wonder what else is under there.
That was developed. They had the wooden beams. They had like a paved road. They had the lanterns. Like it was a tunnel.
It was a for real tunnel. It was like, we're going to use this frequently, bring our families through, travel by tunnel to get away from some stuff. I wondered if it was from, you know, the prohibition eras, if there was like existing tunnels that they just kind of just manipulated a little bit, but I'm going to dive in deeper to that later on today. Cause I just found that so beyond fascinating to me, but I brought it up too, because I mean, you're an East Coaster, you're a New Jersey guy. You're not far from there. You probably knew about the tunnels.
I'm not a Jersey guy just because okay. I look and sound like it. I am.
Okay.
Well, hold on. I'm Jersey's cousin. I am Staten Island.
Oh, how dare I?
Damn right. I'm still New York.
You're still New York. You're not quite out there. You're still New York. Okay. Yeah,
I mean, you know, it's not that bad.
Never said it was bad ever. Jersey's bad. Ever.
That's like, it's an insult.
Oh.
Like, it's like, oh, you're Jersey. I'm not Jersey.
Come on, oh, I didn't know that.
York. Well, at least us guys are here.
Okay. Well, I'm really sorry. I didn't know that.
Jersey people suck at driving.
Oh, okay.
Like, we don't. And so that's the bigger distinction.
Why do you think that is?
You know what it is? I'll tell you why. Because Jersey is still. Oh, you didn't expect that.
That is the most New York. The most. Yeah. You want to know why? I'm going to tell you why. Like, you couldn't have hit it any harder. You couldn't have planned it any better.
Because Jersey doesn't know how to drive because everything is highways over there. They all have highways and parkways and Garden State and all that. And anytime you need to make a turn, you can't make a left turn. You got to do a stupid jug handle to get all the way around to make a left. See, okay. In New York, you got to drive. You can drive, and then there's streets, there's side streets. There's ways to get around, the shortcuts. Like we actually know how to drive. They know how to go straight and make elongated left turns. So I think that.
So there are U-turn people.
Like yeah, there are U-turn people. They have a right on red, which is, I think that's the best thing Jersey has going for it, honestly.
Right on red. Yeah, we have a right on red in certain spots. Your mic's kind of cutting in and out of the first beginning of some of your sentences, so just giving you a heads up.
Sorry,
but you're no, it's all good. So we do the rights on reds. We do them sometimes. We do the U-turns. We have the freeways, but we do have the city driving, so it's not as bad. But you guys also have the snow, so you would think that they would know how to drive.
You would think that, but they don't. And ooh. Yeah, I changed mics. I figured it out. So anytime it's cutting out, it's connecting to my webcam mic, which makes no damn sense. They have this beautiful Yeti here.
You have
not an actual Yeti for anyone who's listening.
Right.
Not the abominable snowman. It's a Yeti mic.
That's right. I mean, again, you are on the East Coast. We could have expected it is cold. So I would have gone with it. But like, hey, let's get into it. Vin, tell me. Why don't you tell the listeners how we met? Why don't you tell them what you're about? And then let me pick your brain.
Awesome. Okay. So we met at David Meltzer's office hours, and that's Meltzer like seltzer. That's how he says it. So I figured, you know.
His birthday today.
No, is it?
It is his birthday today.
Okay.
You have to make a call. I got you.
Okay. Shout out to Mr. Meltzer, and a happy birthday to him and for changing so many people. So, and better yet, bringing people together, right? So that's how we met. We met at the David Meltzer show. We were just handing it off. We were talking about personal development, things you've done, things I've done. And then we started vibing, and then we were like, okay, so that's it. So now we're best friends. So how do we keep this thing going? And like, this is part one, here we are.
And here we are. And it's probably part one of a trilogy. Let's be honest with ourselves. I feel like if you're going to do one, you do it with the New Yorker, because you lean into it, son. I want to ask a million and one questions about your life. And I think I'm going to touch on something. I don't know that you know that I'm going to go there. So bear with me, but I want to I want to know, and I do ask people who were in the area and who were around, because it changed so many of our community's lives in the veteran space, the mental health space, firefighting space. You're a former firefighter. Where were you on 9/11?
Oh, well, on 9/11, I was like 10 years old.
Yeah.
So I was, it was fifth grade. I was in school. I got picked up by my mom, and my brother was home already. I think she picked him up first. I'm not sure. Or he's 7 years older than me. So he was 17. He probably just got let out and got home. But I remember I was sitting there and I was watching the news, but I didn't actually understand what was happening. Cause as a 10-year-old, like, you don't really get it. Mm-hmm. And I definitely wish I had more understanding of what was going on, because I remember, like, my brother had to tell me that what was going on, like, was very serious. And this sticks in my mind because, and I hope nobody sees this as terrible, because I already acknowledge this is terrible. Actually, you could see it as terrible. Just understand, I don't believe this. Right. When I was like 10, you know, and they were filming it, and again, I don't really know what was going on. All I saw, and this is the one thing that sticks into my mind, there was this really fat guy running, and his tie was like slapping him in the face, and I started laughing hysterical. Right. And my brother's like, dude, like, people are dying right now. I was like, what do you mean? Like, that guy's funny. He's like, no, like, this is really bad. Mm-hmm. And I think that I was a pretty innocent kid, even though I'd always been an outcast and I had always gotten bullied. I always tried to look at, like, the sunnier side of things until eventually we'll get into it. Right. But like, then I had my battle with depression and all that, but I was always very lighthearted. Like, I still believed in Santa when I was 10, you know? Right. So seeing that, I didn't really understand it. And, you know, I'm glad that my brother kind of called me out and, like, let me know what was going on. And then fast forward is I was actually, as a firefighter, I was stationed at one of the houses that were one of the first due engines to respond to the World Trade Center. And so one of the things that I would do as a probie is I would clean the glass. And I would clean the memorial and just kind of like take care of the wood and the glass. And, you know, everything was obviously boxed off, so you didn't really have to do much. But it was an interesting feeling, because 9/11 felt differently after that, because I had sat there and I was like, it's very interesting to think that if this were to happen again, I might be the next guy in the memorial. And I was fully prepared for that. And my girl would ask me, she'd be like, if that ever happens, you wouldn't go, right? I was like, what do you mean? Like, you don't sign up to do a job that people call you a hero, right? And not do hero things. I was like, if duty called, I wouldn't, like, I would do my best to get home to you and my daughter. Cause she even said that. She's like, you have a daughter to consider. I was like, I would do my best to get home to you guys, but I would have to do whatever I have to do. I was like, so I hope you can understand that, because that's even something that you kind of realize, right? It's like, you never know what's gonna happen.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's a wild, point. And the reason I bring it up too is because there's a lot of listeners that listen to the show that, you know, the majority are Americans, but forget that they're even Americans. A lot of them are younger, right? And so even though you and I were 10 and 11 years old when 9/11 happened, somehow, I mean, you joined the fire service, you were in one of the houses, I joined the military, I served, you know, the catalyst, it was such a catalyst, a massive point driving factor in a lot of people's careers, their decision-making and their future. And so if I know people have had an experience around that, I like to ask, because it shows perspective and it shows people, because it does feel like this current generation below us, they don't know even what 9/11 is, some of them, and nor do they understand the impact that it had and how it shaped the globe. Because it wasn't just a thing in New York, it wasn't just a thing in America or North America, it was the globe. It was this massive overtaking. So anyway, I always like to ask, but, like, let's talk a little bit about your childhood and how you got to this path of being a psychotherapist, working in mental health, how you became a performance coach, and really what you've done now and how you're seeing your future shape out.
Sure. Well, my childhood was definitely interesting. I could go back to, I would say, virtually any grade year and tell you some form or experience that I had where I was bullied, outcasted. Mm. You know, and there's really ones that stick out more than others. Like, if we sit here, we could just, like, let's go to kindergarten, let's go to first grade, let's go to second.
Right.
And we could do that. But I think there were a lot of definitely more significant moments. Like, one time I got thrown down the steps. Jeez. And then after I got thrown down the steps, the dean blamed me for it. because I told him, well, this is the kicker, right? You're going to love this. I told him, you know, he said, well, what happened? I said, well, he yelled at me. He called me, can I say retard? Because I just did.
I think you saw my face. I think you saw my face. I think you saw my face.
So, I mean, the kid called me that, right? He called me that. He says, move it. And I said, you know, I'll go when I'm ready. And then he said, no, you're going to go now. And he threw me down the steps. Mm. But why would a kid, now for more context, I was like, I don't even know, maybe barely 5 feet. And the kid that told me to go was close to 6 feet. He was one of those weirdly tall middle schoolers. Mm-hmm. And you might be thinking, why would a 5 foot nothing kid tell a 6 foot kid, like, I'll go when I'm ready? Well, I was getting bullied so much that I enrolled in karate. And my sensei told me, you need to learn to stand up for yourself. So me, being highly impressionable, says, yes, sensei, I will. Okay. He said, well, the next person that tries to tell you to do something, you stand your ground. I'm like, yes, sensei, I will. I got thrown down the damn steps.
That's what happened there.
That's what happened there. And then, because I told the dean about that, he said, so you think you're a tough guy. He brought us into a meeting with the principal, said that I think I'm a tough guy and I'm picking fights. And then the principal and the dean said, well, since you're both at fault, nothing will be done. And I'm watching both of you, which means I'm going to get it worse, which I did. So that's kind of how I went in middle school. I also got pantsed by my middle school crush in the schoolyard.
That's the worst.
Oh, my God. And she was selling me. She was like, oh, I think you're cute. I'm like, you know my name? She's like, yeah. She's like, and I like your pants. I'm like, that's a weird compliment. She's like, no, they're really cute, but they look better on the floor. I was like, oh. Yeah. No,
can you imagine if somebody pants the kid nowadays, the amount of assault charges that would be brought up?
Man, if only I had that kind of defense back then.
Oy, oy, oy. I've had that happen with tearaways.
Yeah.
You know those tearaway pants, snap Adidas pants?
Yeah, yeah.
I used to live in those when I was in Taekwondo. Live in those. Adam, I feel you on that. Okay, so you had this life, you had this difficult journey where you went through the ups and downs of the traditional kid, but maybe you got more of it than others. So how did that affect you with your self-esteem at a young age and kind of viewing the world as this, you know, like you said, you believed in Santa, so you were like 10. So, I mean, now all of a sudden this reality strikes where you're not in this innocent world anymore, this protected bubble.
Yeah. Yeah, my parents had to tell me Santa wasn't real because I didn't believe it when the other kids said it.
How'd you take that?
And brought to you by Mindful Meds. You guys have been seeing me take Mindful Meds for a little while now. Mindful Meds is a premium supplement company dedicated to supplying humans with the tools to improve their mental health, clarity, and performance, all while supporting their growth along the way. Whether it's the Immunity Blend, Lion's Mane, Inspire, or Voyage, all of their products are clean, tested, consistent, and they've become a huge help in my life. I found Mindful Meds over a year ago now, and I've never looked back. Go check out their website, mindfulmeds.io, and use the code BRASS at checkout.
I mean, you know, it's like any other kid. I really don't even remember, right? So that's how I kind of look at it. Like, people are like, I won't lie to my kid. As somebody who grew up believing in Santa and my parents had to break it to me, I don't even remember how it affected me, which means it probably wasn't very significant because I remember a lot of other shit.
Right. You know, it's funny though. Not to tangent off this for a second, but it's funny though, because we're going through that with our son. He's 7. He's going on 8 this year. Still believes, strongly believes. Here's the concern I'm falling into is that the ideology of lying to your child and then them finding out and going, because he's the kid who holds on and goes, but you lied to me about that.
Mm.
So what else are you lying about? And I'm like, oh no. Oh, this was the wrong kid to tell Santa was real. Shit. And then this year we leaned in and we did the photo in the house. So it looks like Santa's in the house.
Oh boy.
Oh yeah. So we did more this year. We doubled down. I'm a little nervous. Anyway. So like, talk to me about that. Talk to me about after that path, because the reality strikes. The world is not this place where it's just all safe and rainbows and Santas.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because as a kid, and I, you know, I honestly, anyone who's like under 21 is still a kid roughly, but as a kid. Yeah. But as a kid, you have a lot less understanding. And so even for me, right, I have my daughter now. And it's so interesting. She's close to two. She's a month away. She'll be two, you know, coming up in February. And it's so interesting because she's having trouble articulating anything, right? She still doesn't speak sentences. It's still like broken words, etc. But it's funny because I think about even when I was 13, though I could articulate, I still couldn't articulate.
Mm.
Right? It's a new form of torture. Like my daughter's going through torture because she wants something. And you're like, what do you want? She's like, yeah, yeah. I'm like, what the hell is that?
Exactly.
But she knows what she's saying. Right. So now the frustration of you're like 13, you know what you're feeling, but you don't understand it. That's another form of hell because you can even articulate it, but you're not articulating it enough or you don't understand enough. So for me, one of the ramifications was in middle school, I would call my mom a lot. I would constantly have an upset stomach, like stuck in the bathroom, vomiting. So I don't know that, right? Because you're 13, you're not really too understanding of mental health. All you know is you hate most of your life. And all you also know is that you're always sick and you can't understand it. And then the other part is, and this is the funny thing about how anxiety works and environments, is that when my mom would pick me up from school, as soon as I would get home, my energy is back. I feel great. So much so that my mom would get curious. She'd be like, you know, are you lying to me? I'm like, no. She's like, I don't understand. How is it that every time I pick you up, you're so sick and then you get home and you're fine? And that led to her picking me up less because I couldn't explain it. I'd be like, I don't know, mom. I just feel better. I don't know why.
You felt safe. And
yeah. But you don't know this and you can't articulate that, especially if you're not educated on it. So that was one of the ways that things started affecting me is I would get these bad like rejections in my body, these anxiety panic attacks that would have these physical rejections. Like I would throw up, I couldn't eat, it was terrible. And then I would spend a lot of time with myself. So luckily we had this teacher, his name is Mr. Cottrell, he's a very nice man, and he headed the robotics club. So I wasn't in the robotics club, but he saw that I had a hard time. You know, he saw that kids would steal from me, kids would bully me, like, and one day he's just like, hey, you know, if you want to hang out in my room, because the robotics kids during lunch, most of the time would hang out in his room and they would just do robotic stuff. Be like, hey, you're welcome to hang out. And you know, he was a fellow nerd, so I think he got it. But
yeah, but what an understanding, like what a good human. Like that's the other thing too about these teachers. Like it's, you get the one, it only takes the one.
Yeah, it did. And when he wasn't around, I would seek shelter in the guidance office. So I would go eat lunch alone in there and just try to hang out. And, you know, this is so funny because it's one of those things where it's like, I don't know what the hell is going on with me. I just know like I'm not having a good time of life. And things got much worse for me in high school, where that was like the height of the bullying. I'd gotten thrown in trash cans. And like that story is phenomenal. If you want that story, I'll give you the
story. I want the story. My listeners want the story about the trash can.
Well, we'll do it. Because now I could laugh about it so much. It's like my favorite story to tell because it's so absurd. Because you got to understand, right? And anyone who's listening who might have been in a state of victimhood in their life, you also know, and if you didn't experience this, this was my experience, is that sometimes you get so sick of being a victim that you just start to retaliate back. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've learned about anger is it's a retaliation to your helplessness. Mm-hmm. And so I would felt so helpless for so long that sometimes I would make my bullying worse because I'd rather just get my ass beat worse than continue to just get kicked down and kicked while I'm down.
Right.
And so getting thrown in the trash can was one of the times I made my bullying worse.
Okay.
I had this kid, Mike, football player, built like a brick house. And now, mind you, in high school, I was a little chubby. I had acne. I had bad gyno. So I had those nice fun man tits that everybody likes.
Perfect.
To talk about.
Hey, yeah, right? You're perfect nowadays. You're totally inclusive.
That's it. I couldn't decide between who I wanted to be. So I became both. Are we going to get canceled? I feel like we might.
Listen, you haven't listened to this show before. If you think that's going to be the thing that's going to do it.
Perfect. We'll go harder then. So so I was this kid who was a very easy target. I didn't work out. I was still kind of small and I didn't have any friends. And I was super awkward because I was a gamer and, you know, I didn't have any voice or anything. And so this kid, Mike, would frequently, like, he would do shit. Like, he would bump me or he wouldn't let me sit. So it's always a Mike, you know. It's always a Mike.
Mike or a Brad.
If there are any Mikes out there listening, I bet you're probably a bully, but I hope you're reformed.
Oh, this is fun.
Oh. So, this kid, Mike, he was interesting. You know, he would do those things. Like, he would bump me, he would knock me into the locker. He wouldn't let me sit down in the school cafeteria or whatever the case is. And sometimes he would catch me in the bathroom and he'd like push me around, throw me into the sink. Or like one time he did kind of throw me a little bit, like almost into the trash can, but I caught myself and I was all right, fine. However, I was being a dick because I saw him down the hall one day. And he was like really far. I mean, my hallway was good. And we locked eyes and I knew he saw me and I saw him. And I was like, you know what? Screw him. And I was like, hey, Mike, you ain't going to do shit to me. Screw you, man. And I
bolted into the bathroom. Huh? Did you go in the garage? Did you jump in the trash can?
No, no, no. Come on. The story's not that easy to understand. Okay. It's really going to be movie-esque. Wait until you hear how this happens.
Play it out.
So I jet into this bathroom. I go hide in the stall because I'm like, this is my impenetrable fortress, right? Because it has a lock on the door.
Right.
I'm excited about this. I'm like, I have the upper hand on Mike because like I just told Mike to go screw himself and he can't do anything. I'm in an impenetrable fortress right now. Four walls and me. So I'm feeling like Superman. Mike comes into the bathroom. He's like, where are you? I'm like, I'm in the stall. He goes, come out now. I'm like, screw you again. Right. So he's like, you're going to make this really bad for yourself. I'm like, there ain't nothing you could do, Mike. You know why? Because I'm in here and you're out there. And if you try and come under the stall, I'm going to kick you in the face. And if you try to climb over the stall, I'm going to uppercut you in the jaw. You can't do shit to me, Mike. So why don't you just get out of here? Oh, my God. I felt so good. I felt so good. Even still to this day, do you not see the energy?
Oh, I see how stoked you feel right now. You're reliving. You're reliving right now. This is called exposure therapy, guys. This is what you're experiencing at this moment.
I have all the strength in the universe right now.
That's it.
So Mike, he goes, I'm going to give you the count of three, Infante, to come out of that bathroom. And I'm like, I'm not doing it. I'm not leaving. And you can't do anything about it. He goes, one. I'm like, count all you want. Two. I was like, keep counting, Mike. Three. I was like, you ain't going to do shit. Then it goes silent. Uh-oh. And I just hear, man takes a big deep breath. No. Rams the stall like a lunatic.
Oh.
And you know those crappy locks that you just slide?
Did I just buckle?
It unslid. The door very slowly creaks open.
Oh, I'm even worse. Sitting.
Oh, yeah. I am sitting on the top of the toilet, like holding my freaking legs, like, oh. And he just lets out the biggest snarl. He's like, and he grabs me and he throws me into the trash can and then he pushes me down into it, my knees pressed against my chest. And then he freaking threw some trash in there and like spit on the toilet paper or whatever he spit. He might have spit on me. I don't know. So I'm stuck in this trash can. He just walks out now. I'm stuck in this trash can. I'm trying to roll, do the hobble thing so it knocks over. The bell rings. I'm still stuck in this trash can. Finally knocked over. Go to class late. Get detention for being late without an excuse.
Jesus, man. You asked for that one, though.
I did. I mean, come on. Before the terror.
Yeah, you felt like Superman. Hey, but right. be so grateful. At schools up here, they carry knives and they're allowed to. So
see, I was at an all-boy Catholic school, though. I don't think they would have done that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, certain religions up here, you're allowed to carry knives, right? But only those people, not the rest of us who are not those people.
What do you mean, those people?
Well, certain religions, right? So, like, how do I say it? It's like, so I'm pretty sure Sikh, you're allowed to have a knife, a certain size knife. You're allowed to carry it legally. But, like, you know, Asian people can't. Black people can't, white people can't, everyone else can't have a knife, but Yeah, but
Sikhs
they can.
can.
But Sikhs
So,
can.
so if they could carry a knife, does that technically make them seek and destroy?
Oh, Jesus fucking Christ.
Hey there, humans. I know you guys have seen it, that crown on the top of my head. Well, that is from Three Horses Hat Co., and they are 100% beaver felt hats. That's the highest quality hat you can get, and each one is handmade in Nashville, Tennessee. Three Horses does both custom and one-off hats. They've never made the same hat twice. So, if you design your own, they'll never make it again. If you feel like you can't find a hat that fits your style, that's all right. Go check out Three Horses Hat Co. Use the code BRASS, get 15% off. Embrace the fever, live the dream.
I can't. That'll get us canceled right there. That shit will do it. Oh, I'm pretty sure it's Sikh. I'm pretty sure. I'm not 100%. Let's look it up. Let's look it up together. Let's look it up together.
Okay. I'll get up Chrome.
Sikh. Carry. Hold on. I love how that popped up on my internet search.
Requirement for initiated male Sikhs is that they carry a kirpan on their person at all times.
There it is.
It's usually blunted, and it's generally concealed beneath clothing against the person's body in a sheath and a strap.
There it is.
Okay.
Feels unfair. Feels unfair. I'm just going to say it. But here's the thing. Like, let's tangent on something else. Did you by chance, and you might not because you're a busy human, did you by chance watch Cat Williams' new interview?
I did not. I've seen Shay Shay? Snippets. Snippets.
Oh my God. Okay. He talks about this one point, and I love it, and I resonate with it. I resonate with a lot of that episode, actually, if I'm going to be completely transparent with you, but we don't need to go down that road. But what I will say, as he talks about it, he's like, hey, you've been in jail 15 times, 15 times. And he's like, yeah, but do you notice that I've never put myself there? And he's like, well, what do you mean? Well, what do you mean, Kat? How did you get in jail if you didn't put yourself there? And he's like, well, if I have to carry a weapon to keep myself safe, and you know that 15 out of the 15 times you pull me over, I'm gonna have it, then I'm gonna go to jail. If you know that I smoke weed more than Snoop because of my travel schedule and my eating issues and all of this, and you pull me over 15 out of 15 times, I'm gonna have it. So then I'm gonna go to jail. So he makes it known, like, here's the thing. He says, I would rather be judged by 12 than carried by 6. And I could not agree with that statement more. I carry a knife. I don't apologize for it. I always have it on me. I am 5 foot tall and 110 pounds on a good day. So there's the difference when it's something that you're waving around like a lunatic and being an idiot about, or it's for self-preservation, right? Mm-hmm. I would rather have that conversation than have to have that cop have that conversation with my husband. So I get it and I agree with it. And so when I see that, I was like, oh, well, because of their religion, it's like, do I need to just convert to becoming Sikh? Is that what, because I mean, in Canada, anything goes.
You could have your kirpan.
I could have a kirpan, but I'll bet you'll be sharp. That's all I'm saying. Anyway.
Says they could be dull. It didn't say they had to be.
They could be. Didn't have to be. Exactly. I know, but then I'd have to cover up this beautiful, obnoxiously long hair. And I mean, this hat vibe, it's too good to give up, man. It's too good. When you got a hat from Three Horses, it's too good to give up. Talk to me about how you decided to go from this, and you're a child, so there's only so much you can do here, but this victim mentality as a child to this incredible self-worth and this idea that you can change a billion people's lives and that you can really lead people to do the next great thing. Talk to me about that gap, how we got there.
There was a lot in between there. I mean, so as I said, the worst of the bullying was in high school. Mm-hmm. And honestly, the funniest part is that that's what sparked change, but it didn't actually take place, right? And I think so many people, maybe some of your listeners even resonate with this, is like, you have the awareness that change needs to happen. You don't fully know what to do, but you try some things and they also don't fully work. So instead of just kind of giving a vague description, I'll go into it a little more. For me, high school was the hardest time in my life. There were things that were going on at home that I don't share, and there's no point for me to do that.
No, but, that's your right to do so. Yeah,
there were, and it's not like anything crazy. Like my parents were great.
But it's
like
you things, have your line, man. You have your line.
Yeah, it's things with my brother. He got into a friend circle. It's not a good friend circle, and I like to leave it at that. And that caused some disruption in the home. So I felt like I would go to school, and I was like just getting bullied and ostracized. There was only like one or two kids. I had like one friend, and one kid was genuinely nice to me. And I will share a little bit more about that later, because people need to know the impact that one person can have on your life. And it always chokes me up, so I'm not going to talk about this second, but we'll get back to him. His name is also Mike, funny enough. So one Mike terrorized me, and the other one gave me tons of love. So I was getting terrorized at school. And then I would go home, and, you know, all the stupid crap my brother was doing was a home issue. And so I got super addicted to video games, and I played a lot of World of Warcraft, and I fell in love with World of Warcraft. I was a gamer at that. I mean, I was always a gamer, but now I was a gamer, like 18 hour days, Saturday and Sunday. Ooh. I would sleep for 6 hours, and then I would game all day.
You were for real. That game is no joke too, once you're in it.
No. And especially so. For those of you that don't know what World of Warcraft is, it is an MMORPG, which is massive multiplayer online role-playing game. Mm-hmm. So what that means to a normal person is there is a lot of people, millions all over the world, that are coming together and playing this game in real time online.
And it's a real-time game too. That's the kicker, right?
Correct. Yeah, mm-hmm. You can't pause. So my mom would yell at me. She'd be like, come down, we're eating. I'm like, I can't. She's like, pause it. I'm like, I can't.
I can't. It's online. I didn't design the game, Mom. I can just hear the accent. Ma! Oh, this is so good.
So there would be fights with that too. It'd be like, I don't care about your game. And I'm like, I can't let my guildies down, right? So these are the only friends I have. It became this very interesting interaction. But one of the things I like to talk about is that I created what's called a paladin. And for anyone who's not familiar with fantasy lore, a paladin is a holy warrior. They have healing and divine capabilities like a priest. However, they have plate mail and they use heavy weapons like a warrior. So why I was drawn to the paladin is because of the fact that the paladin was the person I needed. The paladin was a defender of the weak. He was a protector. He was righteous. He was good. He would do things out of justice, and he was kind. And he had a humility to him where everything was to serve the light. And so, I mean, obviously I didn't think that deep when I was younger, but I was very drawn to a paladin, and that's kind of what
there's a reason for it. Right. Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, they even say that you should aspire when you're thinking about personal development. And if this is not what they say, this is what I say. You should think about becoming the person you needed as a child. And I've tried to build myself into that. And that's what ultimately has been a bigger part of my inspiration of how I show up today. Especially when I get on a stage and I speak, and people are like, well, who do you speak to? I'm like, myself as a kid. Mm-hmm. It's just a mirror. So when I think about high school, I had this gaming addiction. I was getting terrorized at school. Home was okay, but not great. And I remember one day I was very tired. Anyone who's gone through the ringer, you might know what I'm talking about here. And I walked in. I was actually close with the principal of my school. Funny enough, he knew my brother. He was a dean at another school that my brother was at. And so he knew that my brother, too? I'm sorry?
All boys school as well?
It wasn't an all boys school, but it was a Catholic school, and it was, you know, mixed. It had boy and girl. And so he knew my family. He knew my brother. He knew what my brother did. Like, cause that's when my brother made his bad group of friends and started doing some dumb crap. So my brother's 7 years older than me.
Right.
So it was very funny because he joined my high school the same year I went to high school. He became the principal. So during orientation, as you know, you're getting familiar with the school, etc. Him and I had some contact, and he goes, I know you. I know your family. I know everything that's going on in your life virtually. I was like, interesting. Okay. And then he said, if you need to talk, I'm here for you. And he kind of left with that. And I took that as an invite, because I always needed somebody to talk to, for being honest. So I would speak with him often. He was pretty updated on my life. And one day I walked into his office, And I just said, hey, Monsignor. He's like, hey, what's up, Vin? I was like, you got a minute? He's like, yeah, sure. Close the door. I'm like, okay. So I came in. I sat down. And he goes, what's up? I just, you know, the usual. What's up? And he said, well, I don't want to be here, man. And he's like, what? Like school? Like nobody wants to be here.
And, I don't want to be here.
He's like, I own this place and I don't want to be here, right? But I'm pretty sure he knew because he was a very insightful man. Yeah. And he goes, what, school? Like trying to break the tension. But it didn't work. And I was just like, no, like I just don't want to be here anymore. Like here. And then he got really stern and he like looked at me and then he looked down at a piece of paper and he goes, and he just goes quiet and he writes a bunch of scribbling. And he just like slides this paper over to me. And he's like, look at that paper. Tell me where you are on there. And I was like, I just look at it. And it says thoughts, planning, attempts. And so it's a very crudely drawn suicide assessment, if I may. And I remember that I pointed to planning and I just broke down crying.
How old were you at this time?
I was like 16 or 17. Yes. It was either junior or senior year. And I remember that that moment was one of the hardest moments because, you know, he had me essentially confront that my only thought of how life will get better is if I don't have to live it. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it's the hardest thing you're ever going to have to do is, in my opinion, is to admit that that's what you're feeling. Mm-hmm. And still to this day, you know, it doesn't feel great, but I think it's important. It's a really important conversation.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, do you need me to call somebody? And I said, no. It's like, you don't have to call anyone. Don't worry about it. I'm not going to do it. But the reason I'm not going to do it is because even though I felt like nobody in the world gave a crap about me, mm-hmm. except is my mom. Mm-hmm. So my mom was always a overbearing Italian mother. And she would always say, mom loves you. You're my whole world. I can't exist without you. If anything ever happened to you, I'd die. And then the thought that pops into your head when you're planning your suicide is like, okay, well, if I grab the knife, because I had to empty the dishwasher every day. My mom cooked every day. It's like, all right, well, if I grab the knife, I could just do it here. But then that's going to be messy. There's going to be a pool of blood. My mom's going to walk in on that. I can't do that to her. And then I had some really weird thoughts. I was like, okay, well, what if I just stand under the air conditioner, tie a string around it and pull it? Mm-hmm. I mean, and like, you just start to try, like, how can I do this? And
everything becomes an option when you're in that.
Everything becomes an option. As absurd as they are, like, really, right? Would that air conditioner have killed me? I don't know. It might have hurt like hell, but I don't think it was high enough to kill me. It was only on the second. Like,
but even like, you'll be driving and it's like, I could just veer into the other lane right now.
Oh, yeah. Of
like
course.
It's everything. And that's what I try to explain to people. Everything.
You get creative. Like, you're freaking creative. You're like, okay, what if I take this remote,
right?
Bang it a few times, get it sharp enough. Like, mm-hmm, you just get like MacGyver. Maybe mm-hmm. MacGyver wasn't a super inventive genius. Maybe he was just highly suicidal. Like,
Could have been. I hear you though. I feel you on that, man.
Right. And so the biggest thing that stuck out though was truly just that. Is I couldn't bear the thought of putting that on my mom. Mm-hmm. Like I really imagined, like as much as I would imagine myself, I would then imagine her walking in. Vin, I'm home. And there just no answer. The weird, like, why isn't he answering? And then the pool of blood as she inevitably walks into the kitchen.
Right.
I couldn't imagine putting that on her. It just couldn't. That hurt so bad that it probably is the thing that kept me alive, honestly.
Yeah.
And so I understand a lot of the times when people commit suicide, it's really because they not only does life hurt, but they truly feel like they want to be missed. And I think that's one of the biggest disservices that somebody who's considering suicide can do to themselves. And like, listen, maybe people haven't said it enough, but I would say that if anyone's struggling out there, you at least owe it to the people in your lives, if even not for you, to just ask them, do you care about me?
Yeah.
Like just get a freaking consensus, because you might really hurt somebody with your presence not being there anymore. And I know a lot of the time we don't realize that. We think our life is so meaningless, it wouldn't create a void. But you misinterpret it sometimes. Sometimes your life is so meaningful, even if it's to one person, that it wouldn't just be a void. It would be a black hole that would continue to suck the happiness out of that person's life if they were to miss your presence.
And it's not even that too, right? It's all of that combined with the ripple. It's the pool effect. It's like, you imagine how good you make somebody feel when you just hold a door for them, or where you just say thank you, or you compliment an outfit, and how much you change just that person's life. So now imagine if you had a child, or you had those around you. They will never feel joy the same way again. They will never feel happiness the same way again. And it's this shock to the system. It's the overwhelming now what. I've seen this in our community. We have 44 a day. I've seen it with the wives and the children. And I think if some of these people truly felt love and truly felt like their presence mattered, they would never, like you said, they would never do that, because they can't fathom the idea. Because now you have these children growing up where they are forever known as the child of the Navy SEAL who killed himself, or the child of the so-and-so who killed themselves, and the widow of, and the this of. And it's this thing that sticks, and it almost is like wet cement everywhere you go for the rest of your life. And I wish people could see just as much as a positive impact as you are as that ripple. That ripple turns into a tsunami when you end up taking your life for those around you. And you don't need to hear it, but I'm going to say it to the small child inside of you. I'm so grateful that you didn't make that decision. And I'm so glad that you stayed with us. And I know you're a grown ass man now, but I'm telling you that truly and deeply and in the most pure sense, because your little girl wouldn't exist. Your wife wouldn't have a partner, and everybody that you've touched to this date in like a non-creepy weird way wouldn't have been touched, you know?
Yeah.
And also, to be honest, to the man that you brought it forward to, he would never have forgiven himself for not stepping in, right?
Of course. I think that it is such a permanent solution to what can be such a temporary problem.
Oh my God.
No matter how bad it is, it's never even as bad as it seems. Like, it just feels bad because you're in it. And sometimes you get tired of stumbling around in the dark, and I get that. There is a light. You just might not be, you might be so close, right? Like, you're stumbling around in the dark, but the light is right around that bend. That's why you can't still see it.
Or you are the light.
You're going to give up. Yeah.
Or you are the light, and you're just so blinded by it, you're not even able to see it. It's like when you look really brightly into a red light or a flashlight, it's like you're blinded by it. It's dark because it's so bright. You know what I mean? Sometimes you can't see outside of yourself to see that you might actually be that light. You were that light for your mother. You were that light for your family. You were that light for those around you. But you're just so close to it that it looks dark.
Mm.
I just, oh.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't realize.
No, you don't. And I'm so grateful that you didn't, man. And I'm glad that you talk so vulnerably about that, because men in particular, I find, struggle with the shame and the guilt of even having the thought. Not enacting it, not even planning it, not carrying it out, but just having the thought. How did you move through that?
You know, before I get to that, I want to say one big thing that I thought about is I've done a lot of work on myself. But one of the things that I keep finding time and time again to ring true is, as a man, the worst thing you could feel is incapable. And I think that's why it's so hard for guys to talk about suicide or thoughts about it, because what that means is you're incapable to live life. Like, forget being incapable of providing for a family, for being able to be a rock for your woman, for being able to be a good father, for being able to be, excelling at your job. All of that pales in comparison to the fact that you don't even feel capable to handle life in that moment. And the worst thing that a man could feel is incapable. Day in and day out, if he needs to feel anything in his world, it is capability. It is that he can be a source. He could be a leader. He could be a rock. He could be whatever he needs to be. And when a man doesn't feel that, it sucks the life out of him. It's like a man without a purpose. If you're a man without a purpose and you're a man without capability, are you even a man? And that's the conversation that maybe you need to have, because just because you don't feel capable, you don't feel purpose in the moment, doesn't mean you don't have it.
Right.
And so I just wanted to throw that thought out, because it literally just came to me.
No, I think it's beautiful.
Thank you. I wanted to make sure I didn't lose it. But what I wound up doing is, because I had been in that place for such a long time, I had realized that I was at this point, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I have to do something, because if I keep living my life this way, I probably will go through with it eventually. I can't keep doing this. And this is where I was saying before, even though you have a wake-up call, you still may not know the right steps. You still may not change the proper way. You still may not do the right things. And that was me. So one of the more silly things, I mean, as if there hadn't already been a bunch of silly things here. One of the more silly things is that these degrees behind me, for anyone who's not watching on video, I have my college degrees. Why? Because they say I'm qualified to do things. Now, what's funny about them is that they say Vincenzo on them. My name is not Vincenzo.
Sure it is.
No, it isn't. It literally is not. It is literally not Vincenzo. That's why I'm telling you. They say Vincenzo, however, because I had built up such a resistance to Vincent, because he was a loser. He got bullied. I was diagnosed with depression, anxiety, and panic disorder. As you all heard, I had a lot of suicidal ideation. I also had self-harm tendencies. I would cut my shoulder. See, I wasn't one of those people that did it for attention, though. Like, I didn't cut my wrist. I cut my shoulder. Like a real man. I want to keep it hidden. I would suffer in silence, truly. Anyone who's listening, don't you do that. Don't you dare.
Don't pull someone. We don't do that.
But I was creative. Anyway, these were all the things I was struggling with. Panic disorder, anxiety, depression. I was like, why would I want to be this person? This person sucks. And so I said, let me reinvent myself. I'm going to be Vincenzo. All my college transcripts, writing Vincenzo on them. First up, why the hell does nobody check that? How is that even possible? Secondly, it sort of worked. I started also going to the gym. I started changing the way I dressed. I grew out a beard. In Catholic school, you can't have a beard. Started spiking my hair. And I really started taking just image more seriously. And it was kind of like that movie, The New Guy, whoever hasn't seen it. This kid was a total loser, gets thrown into this school that nobody's ever heard of him. And he comes in, and he's just, who are you? I'm the new guy. And like, all of a sudden, he's cool. And that was kind of me. So Kelsey, before you asked, like, how did I navigate self-esteem and confidence? I didn't have any. So there was also that component of imposter syndrome of, what if people find out I'm actually a loser? So that was one component. So even though my image changed, the inner work didn't happen. So now, when I didn't have my first girlfriend until I was 18. And so it's very interesting, because now I'm out there in college, right? And I'm single, and girls are interested in me. I have no clue. Like, girls were like, yo, what's wrong with your friend? They would say that to my friends. They'd be like, what's wrong with him? Like, I was flirting with him, and he just like walked away from me. And they'd be like, oh, don't mind Vin. He doesn't get it. Like, you could sit naked in his lap and he would still think that you're not interested in him.
Right.
You know? And then guys started like becoming my friends, and I started having friends, and I started getting some attraction from girls, and I didn't know what to do with any of it. So now there's anxious attachment style. If a girl wasn't texting me all day, every day, she wasn't interested in me. Now there's, if the guys aren't inviting me out or they do anything without me, they're actually planning on dropping me as a friend. So everything continued to always go back to, I'm not good enough for anybody, which would do, like, I became a chameleon, where people were like, what do you like? I'd be like, no, anything. What do you like? They'd be like, oh, I like this. I'm like, dude, I want to try it. And I would go all in. And so I would jump into people's hobbies. Like, I remember at one point there was this game called War Machine. Is this tabletop game where you would buy the miniatures and you put them together and you paint. Like, I was still a nerd, but the kid I met that did that, he was a cool nerd. He was surrounded by girls, you know, he's cool. He worked out, etc. So I was like, oh man, I want to be like this kid. So I went in, I bought like $400 worth of tabletop shit for this game I never played. just so that we could spend almost every day together playing this game.
Right.
Right. That desperate for connection, affection, and approval. Mm-hmm. And so I would just go all in, you know, and I would probably scare a lot of women off that I was really attracted to because I just didn't know how to act around them. And same with the guys. And, you know, I remember I would confront guys that were my friends. Like they would go out without me and I'd text them. I'd be like, did I do something wrong? Like that crazy yeah. crap you see where people make fun of. Like I was like that. Mm-hmm. Like a girl wouldn't text me for like a day because she was busy. And I'd be like, I feel like you don't like me. And they'd be like, mm-hmm. what do you mean? I'd be like, well, if you cared about me, you would text me. And then they finally get back to me and I'd be pissed and I wouldn't answer them. And like, it was crazy, right? I was out of my damn mind.
Sabotage behavior, right?
Oh my God. I was so out of my mind. Like I talk about this now because I can't believe how absurd my thought processes were. Like they were just ludicrous. And so this kind of continued. Now, mind you, I still excelled in everything. I became a personal trainer. I worked that nights. I was a mental health worker at a hospital. I did that on weekends. I was in school full time. And I would always take classes like during the summer and the winter for extra credits. And then I would work full time in the summer. So I wound up graduating Psychi National Honor Society. I had like a 3.8 psych GPA. I had a 3.5 overall. I got accepted to every master's program I applied to. Meanwhile, for high school, I couldn't even get accepted into anything other than my local community college.
Yeah.
So I did a 180 on a lot of these things, but mental health was still on the decline. In my master's program, I was having like mental breakdowns every week. I wanted to drop out of college. My dad would say, you could drop out. You just got to pay rent and go get a job. And I was like, all right, I guess I could stay in college a little longer. So, yeah, that's true. But it was the worst. It was the hardest time for me. And so I would say that was the point where I had to call my therapist anytime I needed to make a decision. I couldn't make a decision. If I had a decision to make, I would call my therapist. If he didn't answer, I would text him. I'd say, please, I need your help. Call me when you can. I was the worst client anybody could ever have. I feel bad for him. But he would always get back to me and whatever. And then I could make a decision. I needed his approval.
It's an approval thing. Okay.
Well, I had no confidence, right? Mm-hmm. No confidence means you can't make decisions because to make a decision, you have to have trust in two things. Trust in an outcome and trust in your capability to follow whatever outcome comes along.
Mm-hmm.
You need to handle it. So mm-hmm. I had zero trust in myself or life. So 23 years old, I graduated college. I have my master's as a therapist now to help people.
It's always the therapist. It's always the therapist. You know
Oh yeah. So I couldn't fathom going to help people yet. I wound up quitting both of my jobs and I just took off and I spent the summer trying to figure out who the hell I was and what I was and all these things. So I had a very life-changing moment that summer because society tells me as a straight white man who is moderately okay, good looking with a hot girlfriend, a fast car, which I had a Camaro SS with a performance exhaust in it, 455 horsepower. It's my gift to myself.
Guys.
Oh yeah, vroom vroom. So,
oh Jesus.
I had the hot girl. I started getting tattoos. I was considering like, hey, I'm getting my body to a place I want it to be. Like I'm looking good. I have my license to practice psychotherapy. I'm 23 years old. Like society tells me this is it. Like you're pinnacle. Mm-hmm. You're the peak, right? Still miserable, still depressed, still anxious. Now angry. Mm. Now angry, right? Because
you got all the things society said you do, the check the boxes and then it'll have the perfect life.
Right. And even better, I was born with the bonus of being a straight white man.
I mean, right? Back then.
Yeah. 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 When it mattered.
We're not 24. We're in 24 now. Well. Yeah. Yeah. Where white privilege really kicked in a gear there. Yeah.
Uh-huh. It was great. I had a credit card with unlimited credit score. It was phenomenal. Now it's gone. I don't know. It just disappeared. Anyway. So it was like, I have everything. Why am I miserable? And then there's the other side, right? Not only does society say you should have all these things and then you'll be happy. However, then there's the other side that if you have all these things and you're not happy, you're not grateful.
Mm.
You have a terrible perspective. people can't empathize with you. It's like, ah, you have a fast car, a hot girl, a good body, and a degree at 23 years old. Ah, it sucks for you. Like,
yeah.
People are more likely to make fun of you and then talk shit behind your back than actually care about why you don't feel good. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't even know what to do. I was like, I can't talk to anybody about this. My friends are already like kind of, you know, throwing jabs at me just for my lifestyle. And then, you know, the other side is like, I can't figure this out. So I remember there's this moment, I call it a moment of grace, where I was so frustrated. Like, again, I was frustrated with life, just full on anger at this point of like, what the hell? What is wrong with me? Right? Super inward. Like, what's wrong with me? I have everything. How can I not be happy? And I freaking slammed my hands on the countertop in the bathroom. And I was just in there venting. I wasn't doing anything else. But slammed my hands on this countertop. And I looked up at myself in the mirror. And it's like this light went on. And it was this moment of clarity where I was like, oh, I get it now. You're Vincent. And see, that was the first time in 7 years that I said my actual name, like my real name, not Vincenzo, Vincent. But why was that so important? And I couldn't figure it out. I mean, I did, but later the reflections are always better, right? Mm-hmm. But it was so important because it was me finally willing to do. So before I tell you this, did you ever hear the term up Schitt's Creek without a paddle?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I live in Canada.
Yeah. Okay. So I like to look at it like you're up Schitt's Creek without an oar. Now, why is that term even real, right? Up Schitt's Creek without a paddle implies that you're going through something that you have zero control of and you're just utterly screwed. That's the life of living in victimhood. That's the victimhood mentality, that life is happening to me. Everything's against me. No matter what, I cannot find control or happiness or joy because this guy's a bully. My brother's doing this. Life isn't good. I feel bad. This, that, everything. But why I like, if you're up Schitt's Creek without an oar, is because oar is my acronym for ownership, accountability, and responsibility. And if you have an oar, you're not up Schitt's Creek, because now you could steer where the boat's going. And so when I figured out, by avoiding being Vincent and creating Vincenzo, I wasn't taking ownership of my life. I was not being accountable for the fact that I am in the current situation I am because of me, because of my thoughts, my behaviors, my actions, my habits, my language, and my emotions. And most importantly, I was not taking responsibility for where I wanted to go in life. So I did not have my oar steering the boat of my life. And I was truly up Schitt's Creek without a paddle. And that is your victim mentality. So in that moment was when I had a very honest conversation. And if there's anyone listening who has not had an honest conversation with themselves yet, please do so. It'll be life-changing for you. In that moment in the mirror, I said, who are you? And the answer was, had to be honest. You're depressed. You're anxious, you're suicidal, you're sad, people pity you, no one admires you, you're not a leader, you are not inspiring, you are not capable. And some people will be like, wow, that's really mean. It's really true. That's who the hell I was. And then once you're honest, because honesty is your starting point, once you're honest, you have given yourself the permission to now create. You go from passively experiencing life to consciously creating it in the minute you decide to take this ownership. Now you can be accountable. So now the question is, who do you want to become? And for me, that answer felt even better, because now the answer is, I want to be someone who's excited and loving and powerful and inspiring and helpful. I want to be a leader. I want to lead others into better lives. I want to do so much more than I currently am. And then the last question, this is where the responsibility comes in, right? The last question is, what do you have to do to become all of those things? Because our internal world is what shapes our reality. And so if I say, well, I want to be a leader. Now, this is what I talk about, is that we all have internal leadership, or we should. Internal leadership is the understanding that you have multiple identities within you. And how you show up powerfully for each identity determines what you must do. But then the question is, well, how the hell do I know what to do? And this I call, I'm throwing a lot of concepts at you, and we could circle back.
No, it's good. Hit it.
This I call my five aspects of mastery. So what you must do to become the best version of that is, one, you define the identity, say like, what is a leader? And then you use the five aspects of mastery, which is understanding the language, the thoughts, the emotions, the behaviors, and the actions. And when you could focus on those five, because they're all internal, you actually develop your full aspects, your self-mastery. Now you can control anything. You could turn adversity into advantage, pain into power, whatever you want to call it. But when you develop that strong focus, everything becomes clear. So as a father, if I say my most empowered version of a father is this, what's the outcome I want to achieve? How do I want to raise my daughter? Well, I want to be present. What does presence look like? Well, presence looks like me put my phone away, me dedicate intentional time to her, me play with her, me interact with her, me be kind to her. What's the language I need to use? Words that would be compassionate, understanding. What's the emotions I should inspire in her as a present father? What's the emotions I want to have as a present father? I want to be happy with her. I want her to laugh. I want to inspire excitement and joy. What are the behaviors of a higher version of a father? What are his actions? You see, and when you get super granular like this, the only way you can't succeed is if you consciously don't put in that effort. Mm-hmm. Because now you're freaking clear and it's fully on you. Mm-hmm. And once you're exposed to something through the law of exposure, once you're exposed to something, you can never not be exposed to it. So if you know what it means to be the best version of you and you're not doing it, you're just lazy and you don't want it, period.
Right. Yeah. And the other thing is too, is the authenticity, right? Who are you? You have to be willing to have that conversation. The mirror technique is one of the best things. It's the best things. Looking in your eyes. I know a ton of people who cannot look themselves in the eyes in the mirror.
Oh yeah.
It's tragic.
Hard. It's hard though. It's hard because in that moment, and I can recall it like it was yesterday, in that moment, you no longer are able to blame anyone else. Mm-hmm. In that moment, if you've been doing something, and listen, I've had clients who I've worked with who are like in their 50s, that they've had something that they've held on to since they were 10. Because in that moment, if you take responsibility and ownership and accountability, all of a sudden, you have to blame yourself that for the last 40 years, you have shaped your life because of something you chose to hold on to. And that is going to hurt because now you're going to understand you screwed yourself for 40 years. You have to accept that.
Yeah, you wasted that precious time, that energy, everything that you could have. And it's amazing to see the shifts that are happening in this generation. People are wanting to heal much younger. People are wanting to attack their problems much earlier. And they're no longer waiting or accepting the fact that they have to be X, Y, and Z because somebody or something happened to them. That victim mentality is shifting for our, my, and your generation. The one after us seems to bathe, eat, sleep, breathe the victim mentality as if it's going to benefit them somehow. And they're going to be the individuals who wake up in their 40s and their 50s and their 60s and go, what the hell was I doing? What a waste. What a waste of life and time.
It's tragic. It's so tragic, right? They say some people get buried. Is it they get buried at 60, but they die at 20?
Oh. That's, what is it? What even are they, Gen Z? Is that what they're called? This I one? Know. I don't even know. These individuals. Wait,
aren't we Gen Z?
Are we Gen Z?
I don't know.
Wait, what are we, 89 and 88? 89?
I'm 91. 89?
That sucks for you. I'm in the 80s. I don't know what to tell you.
80s? 80s people are so proud. It's like, I am in the 80s. You're 89. You're like a year freaking off the 90s. Calm down.
I'm like 3 months. I'm September too. It's even worse. But listen, I'm going to bake myself in that identity and know that that's just where that number sits for me. Okay. I don't need to hear about it. I know where I'm at. I know who I am. I talk to myself in the mirror every day. I know exactly who I am. But it's ironic that you say those things too, because when you look back at your life and you look at these plans that you're putting forward and these tools that you're this verbiage you're putting out for individuals that are listening, some of them are going to be met with, oh my God, an awakening and acceptance and understanding that these are the things I should be doing. And then others are going to hear that and go, this guy's full of shit, and turn it off.
Oh yeah.
Because the light that's so bright and the healing that you've done, it irritates.
Mm-hmm.
because they know how much they missed out on. They know how, the things that they could be doing, but to do those things requires severe amounts of accountability. This is why I struggle with programs like the 12 step. And I struggle with this idea that we have to always give over to someone else. The accountability and the responsibility to heal any of the things that you have done in your life is on you and solely on you. And the sooner you accept that, the sooner you move forward. But the second you say, I'm giving responsibility to someone else, to something else, whatever it may be, you are now devoid of that opportunity to learn and grow. You are stuck in that state of when they said you did the wrong thing or you shouldn't have been doing the thing. And I encourage others to listen back to this. And we're going to actually make that the clip at the very beginning of the episode, because I think it's so, I think it's so bloody fantastic how you describe the simplicity of it. Because it really is, it is quite simplistic once you sit down and you go point A, this point B, this point C, this accountability, honesty, openness, and willingness. Because that's really what it comes down to. If you're not open and honest and willing, none of those tools are going to help you in any way.
Exactly. It's interesting too, because a lot of people, and I'm putting this out there more because one of the things that I'm still in the process of doing is building my brand. Mm. And one of the things that I'm very proud of to say out loud and continue to now push is that I am a practicing Stoic. And I think if you truly want to understand how to master life, you should study Stoicism. Stoicism, in my opinion, is the original form of self-mastery. I mean, it is, right? Like, that's what a Stoic believes. Stoics are not people that are cold, heartless. And we've used that for a while, right? It's like somebody has no affect and no emotion. Like, wow, they're very Stoic. It's like, that's not Stoicism.
No.
That person is disconnected from reality. That's not Stoicism. Stoicism is what I talk about. It's about understanding there's two worlds, the one inside and the one outside. You can't do a damn thing about the outside one. You could try to influence it, but the only way you're going to influence it is from having more control over the inner world. So as long as you focus internally, you can start creating a life worthwhile. And I pair my Stoicism with like my background in therapy and my background in coaching. And that's how I am able to not only get great results for me, but for other people. And so I always tell others, it's like, if you really want to learn some stuff, forget therapy, forget coaching, go read some Stoic stuff, go learn about, like, there are some really fascinating people in there. There was one guy and they were like, hey, you're going to die tomorrow. He's like, all right, what are you going to do? Somebody was like, hey, skip town. It's like, I'm not skipping town. I'm going to have a party tonight. He's like, why would you do that? They're going to kill you. He's like, they're going to try and kill me anyway. And if I leave, they're going to hunt me down. I'm going to party tonight. Mm-hmm. Like, don't get me wrong. That's a true Stoic, because Stoicism preaches you have the opportunity to meet every experience with enthusiasm in your life. Mm-hmm. Jocko Willink says some pretty interesting things too. Is like, every time something goes wrong, he's like, good, right? Like, but why does
not
he say
he says
good
in real life? But it's
not. Right, well, that's what he says in his stories, right? But what's the intention behind that story? Is good because you have some sort of opportunity, you have a way to look at it with enthusiasm. I look at life that way too, and don't get me wrong, we're all humans. I say I'm practicing. For instance, I didn't know for the longest time why they call it a therapy practice, but they call it a practice because you're supposed to continuously do it, right?
Right.
So anytime you say, I'm a practicing Stoic, I'm a practicing coach, I'm a practicing therapist, I still do not believe and don't think I ever will fully arrive. But that is also the power of striving for self-mastery, is that you know that there are always ways you can do those shifts. You could always inspire more, be more, do more. And that doesn't have to be discouraging. People get discouraged by that, but it should be enticing and exciting to know that you have an opportunity to not only go through this life, but to constantly find things to do. How boring would life be if you've ever truly made it and there's nothing left to do? Wouldn't that suck? Like,
that's why you see billionaires and millionaires and all these people who have a ton of money, who sell their companies, and they're still miserable and depressed. They're still struggling. They still don't know what to do. But they have all the freedom to do it. They don't know how to handle it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's it. I always encourage it. Just have fun. Build life. Build your life. Just keep building it. Keep focusing on this. And everything will be good.
Well, and that's the other thing too. I love that you said it's like, you know, this life worth living, but I believe it's this life worth dying for. I think we have this idea that we should always be building this spectacular life. But when I look back at my life, the defining moment and the question I always ask myself, am I living a life that's worth dying for? Am I living a life that others, I will ask them to go fight for me, or I will have people stand up for me? Is it a life worth dying for at the end of the day? Because ultimately, whether we like it or not, wars are going to exist. Things are going to happen. We are always going to ask innocent people to go fight for ourselves. But what are we asking them to go fight for? Is it worth them dying for? And if it's not, then you better look yourself in the mirror, correct your shit, and make it so that when the 18 and 19 and 20-year-old go out and start putting their life on the line for you, their life is worth dying for. Because I'll tell you right now, most of those people right there, they, if they knew the way you were acting, they would not go. If they knew what they were actually going to do, they would not go.
Yeah.
So you damn well better be showing up and living a life worth dying for. Forget living for. I want to know that if I'm going to send people to protect you, it's going to be worth it. And it's that idea that, you know, when you have children, it's, I don't want to show them how to just exist. I want to show them how to live. Are you willing to live for your family and for your children? Are you willing to live for your neighbors and for those around you rather than just exist because you were here? We're all here, but it's what we choose to do with the time when we are here. And if you're not doing anything with it, then don't you dare ask others to go die for it, because you don't deserve it.
I agree. You have to, it's about being a beacon. Why I want to be a speaker so bad, or I should say why I became a speaker and why I continue to want to do so, is because of the fact that now, obviously, when I was in, you know, high school and college, which were some of my darker days, we had the internet, which was great. You know, the internet was a great invention, even though we had, at least at the start, we had the dial-up. I'd get kicked off when there was a phone ring. I used to yell at my mom, "Don't answer the phone, I'm playing a game."
Oh, I remember that.
And I remember, as you know, YouTube and started coming out, and Google and all this stuff, and it started becoming a lot more mainstream, I would listen to speakers in my dark days and my dark hours. And I remember there would be times where I was trying to improve myself, and I would be getting up at like 4 a.m. And the only thing that would be heard in my house was Les Brown yelling at me over the microphone. And it was those things where I could feel them breathing life into me. And I said, if these guys are able to help save my life just by speaking, I have an opportunity to do the same. And I feel like if I am someone who's capable of doing that, I don't just have an opportunity, I have a responsibility. Because when you truly discover why you're here, what you're supposed to do, what are you supposed to learn or teach or experience, you should make it your mission to do that. I've had moments where I've come to understand and come to believe, like, I am here to impact lives. I have walked this path my whole life. I have been dedicated to service of others forever. Even when I couldn't do it and be capable for myself as a kid, I was still trying to help others. I was still kind to my friends. I was still, even though I was a bullied kid, I was still never one to bully. And I've always held that to my heart. I've been in mental health for coming up on 14 years now. I'm 32. I've been in it for 14, coming up on 14 years. I started at like 18 working professionally, or 17. Sorry. So I, you know, whenever somebody's like, "Oh, are you truly like about?" Yeah, no, my whole damn life. And even when I wasn't doing this, I was still serving as a firefighter, right? Now as a coach and as an entrepreneur and a mentor. And so I think when people step into their power, things start happening, but you have to really do that work to uncover it. You have to be willing to try and figure it out, and you have to be willing to fail and fumble. And there were many hard moments in my life, but that's okay. They're supposed to be. They're there because they're challenging you to level up and grow. Like, I like to look at life as a video game. Mm-hmm. They've never made a video game where there is an unbeatable boss battle. So if that's the case, why didn't you defeat that boss? Well, let's look at it. You might not have leveled up. You might not have the right gear. You might be in the wrong zone. Maybe you need a team to help you. Perhaps it's just not the right time for you. maybe you were playing the game and you're too tired to get the hand movements down. There's a million reasons as to why you didn't beat that boss, but I will guarantee you that boss is beatable. You just have to get curious as to why you have yet to succeed. Seek mm-hmm. out the answer, practice, perfect, and overcome, and then go to the next thing. Mm-hmm. And so I look at life in that form. I like to gamify it, but most importantly, I love to carry the understanding. And you said before, like, living a life worth dying for. I also believe that when you look at life, life is meaningless and it's supposed to be, but that shouldn't be confused with life being pointless. If life was pointless, we wouldn't be here. But right. life is meaningless because we have that beautiful opportunity to define whatever we want out of life. We can make mm-hmm. anything have meaning. You could be super excited about brimmed hats and I could hate the hell out of them. Mm-hmm. But maybe your meaning in life is to find really great brimmed hats and mine is to avoid them at all costs. And neither of us are wrong. We're just living our best lives in the way we've decided it should have meaning to us. Mm-hmm. And that's also one of the things I love about your title, Brass and Unity. That's actually how you create unity, is understanding that everyone has different meanings and that we should all be excited about everybody figuring out their meaning and living that version.
And that purpose, right? We all have it. We just have to find it. The second you find your purpose, everything explodes.
Yeah.
Everything explodes. But we have a generation of individuals who run around with no clue as to what their purpose is. We have a generation of individuals who wake up and go, I don't have a direction. I don't have a purpose. I don't have a God. I don't have anything other than a fucking blue-haired person on TikTok yelling at me that I need to be somebody else when I just want to be myself. But nobody has shown me how to be myself. Hmm. What's wrong with just being the self that you're born with? What's wrong with just accepting the person that you are? Why do we have to always change the thing? Why can't we improve on the thing? Why can't we improve on the life that we've been given?
Right.
It's so difficult for me. I see it so often. It's so easy for you. 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 Who the fuck ever said it was going to be easy? Whoever told you that when you were born, you were guaranteed to have the easy route? Because whoever did told you it was fucking delusional. Or hasn't been through anything in their life or hasn't been faced with the punch of the world yet. But give it time, because I assure you it will come. And the second that we realize that sometimes our purpose is just to exist until our purpose shows up for us. Yeah. We have to find the path, but sometimes the path isn't there and it's not clear until all of a sudden it is. I've done my company for almost a decade now, but my show only started 4 years ago. I didn't start the company with the idea to create a community that could heal each other. I started the company to create a way to save me from myself. And when you do start to do things from the perspective of the open hand, when you start to truly come at every experience with the open hand, the open heart, the open hand, the open mind. And you do things for others without asking for anything in return. That's when it all comes back. But the second you start to do things for you selfishly, you'll realize super quickly around in this world that it's not going to work out for you. It's not going to be faced with this great opportunity because you're clenched fist. You're going at the world with a clenched fist, and the world does not respond to a clenched fist because there's no way for you to receive. You have to open yourself up. You have to be vulnerable. You have to have your hands here. I'm here with an open hand. How can I help? What can I do? How do I serve? And it doesn't mean serve God. It doesn't mean serve some greater religion or some guy with a beard. It doesn't mean any of that. It means, how do I serve humanity, this time, this purpose, these people? How do I show up? It's about how you choose to show up. Mm. But most people, they don't even think they're worth showing up.
Right.
The self-love and the self-worth has been so broken down over these decades of just constant fighting and turmoil and division. We have no self-love and self-worth. We're not born into that anymore. We have to be taught it. How sad is it that we are brought on the face of the earth and we have to be taught how to love ourselves because we are so beaten down. How sad is it that we have to show up and have to learn what our self-worth is when our self-worth is just that. We are here, we are breathing, we are existing. How grateful should we be just for that? But that's not the way it is anymore. That's why people like you and I have to exist, because not everybody can get access to a fucking psychologist or a psychiatrist. Not every psychiatrist or psychologist fully understands the depth of the self-worth or the self-love or walking that path, right? That's why people like you and I have to exist. We have to talk. We have to be open. We have to go down through these journeys. We have to get down to the nitty gritty and tell the stories of when we wanted to die so that people can sit there and go, holy shit, somebody else said it. Somebody else made me feel what I was feeling, but I'm not alone in that. And I never had to be alone in that. I could be something greater, but I needed someone to grab my hand and say, hey, buddy, it's okay. It's fucking okay. Because you have to feel that shit to heal that. And until you're willing to feel it, you're never going to heal it. You're never going to find that purpose and you're never going to get to that next level. So embrace the pain. Embrace the hurt, the dark, the sadness, the everything that comes with the feeling of no longer wanting to exist on the face of this earth. It's okay to admit it. You don't have to live in it. You can grow from it. And so I'm so grateful. I wanted to have you on the show. I know you're going to be back time after time after time after time because you and I have so much to dive into. We have so much in common where we can share and where we can help others through the tools that you can provide. You fill the gaps that I have and I fill the gaps that you have. We both have a place in this world, and that's the beautiful thing, dude. Yeah. We all have a place in this world. We just have to see it.
And there's more than enough for everybody.
Oh, right? My God.
You know, when I first started coaching, I was like, oh, man, who would go to me? Like, there's so many amazing coaches out there. Like, Tony Robbins is the best coach in the world. How can I compete? Well, it's actually very simple. There are a lot of people who don't even know who Tony Robbins is. Mm-hmm. There's also a lot of people who don't like Tony Robbins. Mm-hmm. And even if you do like Tony Robbins, the man charges $1 million a year for coaching, and he only has 4 clients per year. I would say there's a hell of a lot of opportunity for me, even with Tony Robbins out there doing his thing. Mm-hmm. And when we step into the abundant mindset that there is so much out there for everyone, all of a sudden your life starts shifting in the best way possible because you're no longer operating of there's not going to be enough for me or this, that. I mean, don't get me wrong. That's where I used to be too. That's why I understand it. And that's why I can
point limiting belief.
It's a limiting belief. And you know, to one of the points that you made, or you made a lot of good points, but I think there's something in there that I think is super important. In today's generation, the problem that I see, or one of the biggest ones, is that people are so damn focused on happiness. And that is such the wrong freaking move. Mm-hmm. Happiness is, it's like a drug. You could chase it because happiness is an emotion. You can't feel happy all the time, but what you could do is you could do the thing that makes you happy. Happiness comes from being productive. If you focus on finding your purpose, as we were talking about before, and even if you don't find your purpose, just be somebody who's valuable. Just go do things that make you go to the gym, go be a good person, go show up for your family, go be a good friend. If you don't have friends, go find some, like do things that make you feel like you're moving forward with your life. And when you feel that, now we could talk a little about the science of it, right? Dopamine's released. It's the drug of achievement. When you achieve crap, you feel good. It's scientifically proven now. This isn't even my opinion anymore. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean? To actually achieve happiness is to achieve productivity, to create value. So if you want to be happy, just become valuable. Everything I do with people is an experiment on their identity. Mm-hmm. When I've looked at how I create my life or how I help people live a better life for themselves, what I'm actually doing is challenging you to shift your identity. Who do you want to become? And then how do you do that every day? And guess what? All of a sudden you're productive because now you're building something. Even if it's the most simple thing, which is you building yourself. Building and productivity lead to sustained happiness. And why it's important to have the mindset that isn't depressing that you always have something to do is because if you could always be productive because there's always something to do, you could have sustainable happiness. It's that freaking simple.
And you know what the other thing is too? Flip that Tell mindset, me. Flip the mindset right there. I don't have something to do. I get to do the thing.
Damn right. I get to go in day in and day out and be better.
And I get to. I don't have to. I get to. It's the choice that I make. It's how you reframe that shit.
Exactly. It's the small shifts, right? It's in the 5 aspects of mastery. It's your language. See, what is your language? How do you determine things? I could listen to someone talk and I could tell you, within, I would say at this point in my life, like a 99% accuracy rating, what their life is like based on how they talk. I don't need to know their past. I don't need to know what they're doing in their life. I don't need to know what their future goals are. I don't even need to know what their home is like. If you talk to me for an hour and I just ask you questions, the language you use is going to tell me everything I need to know about you.
Absolutely.
It's so crazy because humans are so easy to understand if you just freaking pay attention, which again, if you listen, right? Which it all just comes back to again of like, if you're just careful and intentional, like those five aspects of mastery, I stand by those things. Like I created that shit because that's what changed my life. But if you're just intentional, how am I showing up? What is my behaviors, my actions? What are my thoughts? What am I thinking? What's my language? What's my emotion? What are these patterns? 95% of everything we do is just run on autopilot in the subconscious mind. That's the average. So if you're telling me that there's some aspects of your life that you're not happy with, where does that exist? It exists in your 95% subconscious. Do you know how you change it? Become conscious. It's
bring
like
it to the awareness. That's
bring
it
to the awareness. I put out a story yesterday that probably got more likes than more of my other recent stories. And the story on my Instagram simply said this: is like, if you want to change your life, the easiest way to start is before you do anything, ask yourself a yes or no question. Is this getting me closer to the person I want to become in my future? Yes or no? Like, that's it. It's a yes or no. Like, oh, I say I want to move on and heal. Should I text my ex? Oh, well, you know, yes or no, bro. It's a yes or no. Everything in life could be a yes or no if you want it to be. Humans are just, we make shit complex, but everything could be yes or no.
Of course we do. We overcomplicate it. So then we have an excuse when we fail.
Yeah.
I didn't do the thing. I showed up a little late. Yeah. I'm always a late person. No, you're a late person because you don't give a shit.
Yeah.
That's it. Try. Yeah. You don't want to show up. You're not ready for that. Okay, that's okay. Cool. When you're ready for it, you'll show up correct. It's like that idea, like our friend Renee, our mutual friend Renee that we met, brilliant man. He posted something the other day and it's like, how do you stand out when you go into these rooms? How do you stand out? Like, how do you speak? How do you carry yourself? Your body language, because he's really big on that, right? And he's saying all these really great things. And then I just said, or a great fucking outfit. And he's like, you're right. Because it matters. What you wear matters. What you eat matters. Who you hang around matters. The energy. What do you tell yourself before you walk in a room? What do you say? I don't know if I belong here. Well, I don't give a shit if you think you belong there. You're about to walk in there, so you damn well better act accordingly. And if you don't know how to do it, then look up how to do it. There's so much abundance. There's an abundance, and that is the word for the year. It's abundance, abundance, abundance. There's so much. The excuse that you're unhealthy no longer exists with the amount of technology. The excuse that you don't want to try anymore no longer exists because there's gyms on every corner. There's fucking outside exists. Still, like, there is no longer excuses for your behavior. So when you say I did X, but I should have done this, then that is just telling me that you're not ready to make that step. And that's okay.
Yeah.
But if I am your coach and you say I want to do this, then you damn well better start doing the thing. Otherwise, what are you paying me for?
Exactly.
Right.
You need to become a person of your standard, a person of your word, like me. I'm very happy to say that I've definitely become a man of my word. And I could say that too, even, you know, full transparency, which I have never been transparent, at least on this podcast, or honestly, anyone. Let's just go with that. I'm always open because I believe you should lead with vulnerability because it becomes your invulnerability. Mm-hmm. But for example, would you say, Kelsey, that I've shown up with some good energy here today, that I seem excited and into this, right?
Yeah, you're a present guest. You're like the dream guest. It's easy.
Well, thank you. Can I tell you, 10 minutes before our podcast, I literally turned around to my girlfriend and said, I really don't want to fucking do this podcast today.
Why is that?
I was just having a pretty crappy day. I had a crappy day. Things stacked up early this morning. I got a crappy workout because I let myself get distracted while I was in the gym, like answering text messages. And I never do that. I put my phone on do not disturb, but I was sending out some messages and I was waiting for these answers and they started coming in while I was in the gym. Right. So now left the gym a little early. I was so frustrated. Then I went to the next thing and I'm sitting there stewing. Like I got my hair cut and my barber's like, how's your day? I'm like, that's fine. I just didn't feel like unloading anything, you know? And so I get home, I eat real quick. Cause I didn't have much time. Like I got home like 20 minutes before we started. And my girl's like, oh, what do you got now? I'm like, I have a podcast. I really don't want to get on this right now. I'm not in the damn mood. But if there's one thing that I've learned in all of my time of doing my personal development and what I teach as a coach and all this, is that you have the power to shift like that at any given moment if you choose. And I already said, and she goes, could you just cancel? Could you just tell her maybe later in the day or tomorrow? And I said, that's not who I am. That's not what I do. So I will get on and I will be great. And I know I'll be great. That's just how I feel right now, right this second. But in 10 minutes, I'm going to be phenomenal. And I know that because I have this capability, because I've spent so much time just being real and exploring myself of like, well, how can I do that? And one is like, don't get sucked into it. I might acknowledge like, I really don't want to do this right now. However, one thing that I've learned in life, and this was instilled by my parents, is they didn't let me quit stuff. I would say, I don't want to do this. And they'd be like, you're going to do it and you'll feel better. Just go do it. And I'd be pissed. I'd be like, no. And I fight with them and I fight with them. And then I do it and they'd be like, how was it? I was like, yeah, it's good. And it's the same here. Why would I cancel on this podcast? I've been looking forward to this. It took us like almost 2 months to get this on the books. I was excited for it. I could not wait to be here with you and your energy. I could not wait to share my message because my mission is to impact a billion lives. And every platform gives me the opportunity to reach one more person. There's so much in here. Why would I back out of it? And I knew that once I got on, it wouldn't just be good. It would be phenomenal. And so the minute we turned on the camera, I was like, hell yeah, let's go. And I'm super glad I did.
I feel you. And I'm so glad you did too. And you're going to come back. But I can tell you, like, trust, I did not want to go outside in 35 degrees with a wind chilled with the minus 10 and go sit in a fucking tub full of ice. But I did it because I know you can wrestle with your thoughts. You can wrestle with this idea. But you're wrestling with the shadow self. You're wrestling with the ego, the thing that the self-sabotaging behavior that comes up that stops you from being who you can be. And so you have to do these things. That's the whole point, is doing the difficult things will make the easy things that much easier. It makes it that much more enjoyable, my friend. And I feel you. And I'm so grateful that you did. I know we had to reschedule this week. My son was, he's just coming out of a 3-week sickness. And I'm so grateful. So thank you for that. And for your willingness to be so accommodating. I do appreciate it deeply. You are a parent. You understand sometimes the fam's got to come. It's got to come first, right?
They always come first. They should always come first.
Tiny humans.
Yeah. I mean, listen, you and I can always do a podcast. Like that shit doesn't matter. And if for some reason I die, listen, there's plenty of podcasts of me out there already. You need time with your kid because your kid, you never get back. You never get that time back. It's so precious and fleeting.
And you would say that, but you know what? I'm gonna address that right there. Because sometimes, your family always comes first. And I feel you on that to the deepest of my core. But I will tell you, I've had a guest on the show who has since passed away. And he became a good friend. And he touched my heart. And now when I look back at our clips, I'm so grateful that we did the show. Because I had the moments with him. Yeah. I had the moments. I even get emotional about thinking about it. But he's a good person in this world, man. He's just one of those people.
Yeah.
And then so the beautiful thing about these shows is people think that you do it for money and for all of these things, but it's the connection, it's the container, the holding, the container, giving people the space. That's what I feel like I do well. I give you the space to be you, to hold whatever it is you need to hold, to be held. And then it's documented and it's there. So one day when your daughter grows up, if something ever happens, she can look back and go, look at my dad, full of life, full of happiness, full of passion, full of the thing he wanted to do the most in the world that he was great at. It's there and it's here. And it's not going anywhere. And I think as much as our families are first, you have to love what you do. You have to love it, every part of it. And so I'm so grateful that you took the time, my friend. I'm so grateful that you showed up the way you did. And thank you for that. And I know my listeners are going to be super stoked to have you come back on. And I'm going to chat with you as soon as we get off here. But before we go, please tell everyone where they can support you, work with you, hire you, and be in your circle moving forward.
Thank you. Yeah, of course. Well, as I said before, but I'll say it again, is the pleasure is mine to, one, know you, and two, to be able to connect with you. So thank you for having me. People can find me on my website, It's just my name. It's www.vincentinfante.life and then .life because like SEO play and I'm life coach and live your life, damn it. So not .com or anything else, .life. And you can find me on social media. It's vin.infante on Instagram. TikTok is same thing. Twitter. Like I'm Vin Infante everywhere. I don't do the Vincent because honestly, let's be real. Like my mom calls me Vincent when she's mad at me. In fact, she does it all. She's like Vincent Arturo Infante. And I'm like, ooh.
Ooh, that got intense. Yeah.
That's the tough one. So we like to stay far away from that. It's like, you just call me Vin. I'm not in trouble with any of y'all. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe somebody's going to call me up and be like, your podcast sucked. You were offensive. And I'm calling you Vincent. I'll be like, you called me Vincent. That's the one I'm the most upset about, actually.
Well, they should have known what they were watching. Be honest with ourselves. Amazing. Well, we're going to put everything in the show notes so everyone can follow you and find you. Again, it's my pleasure. I cannot wait to have you back. You stick with me. Everyone else, see y'all next week.